not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
You bet. Guy James here with you once again on a Wednesday edition of the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. Thank you for joining us today. Good to have all of you along. Very newsworthy day. This is going to be a busy, busy, busy show today. We are going to have Chris Steller from the Minnesota Independent on to talk about our most insane congressperson, and that would be Michelle Bachmann. A little later on, we're going to have Jake DiLiberto on from Rethink Afghanistan. He's a former Marine. We're going to talk about that ill-begotten venture. And then in the second hour, we're going to have Congresswoman Allison Schwartz from the 13th District of Pennsylvania, including Northeast Philadelphia, to talk about health care. So we're going to be busy, busy, busy today. Let's see. We have a cop killer in Pittsburgh, ambushed cops and killed them. We have the Tiller murder just a week or so ago. We have a white supremacist going in the Holocaust Museum today and shooting people, 88 years old white supremacist, a freeper, by the way. Yes, I said a freeper, by the way. I was thinking, there's not a Muslim amongst those people, is there? We're worried about having Muslim terrorists running all over the country, killing folks. And who is it that's doing the killing? Who, once again, I have my hand up to my ear. Who is it? Do I hear an answer? Who is doing these killings? These political killings? Not any Muslims, is it? No. But yet we have Congress people running around going, oh my God, we can't have these people running around this country. They've got to turn them loose. And who knows what'll happen. Why, they'll breed and there'll be millions of them. They'll take us over. And yeah. Seems to me that mostly, with your Ted Kaczynski's and Jeffrey Dahmer's and what's his name that bombed the Oklahoma City building? Tim and his cohort and the guy that murdered Mr. Tiller and this guy at the Holocaust Museum, seems to me they all share something. They all have something in common now, don't they? Jim McVeigh and Nichols, his helper. What is it they all have in common? All together now, what is it that Jim McVeigh, Nichols, the cop killer from Pittsburgh, the murderer of Mr. Tiller, the white supremacist today, and the Holocaust Museum, what is it they all have in common? Ah, yes, they're all angry white guys. You got it. They're all angry white guys. Not Muslims. No, 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 no. Uh-huh. And yet, we hear this tortured cry coming from the halls of Congress and elsewhere, wherever they can get a microphone. Oh, my God, we can't have these terrorists in our neighborhoods. What will we do? Mm-hmm. Indeed, what will we do? And that brings me to the subject I wanted to talk about yesterday. Didn't get a chance to. We had a busy show, and I'm going to take a couple of minutes to tell you right now. Actually, this is my first chance since last week to comment on the president's speech in Cairo. And I've had a lot of time to gather my thoughts instead of giving you an off the cuff immediate response, which might have been more emotional than thoughtful. I want to preface my remarks by saying, and you know, I love this president. I do. I love him. He represents that proverbial breath of fresh air that we all talked about since President Kennedy occupied the White House. The whole scene, him, his wife, Michelle, and his cute little kids, and even the dog. There's something magical about this new first family. They're not perfect, but they're truly inspirational. But back to his speech. After watching the reactions of a lot of people, I know the speech was very well received in this country. Very well received. Except for the craziest of the crazy right-wingers and the Christian conservatives who, whenever you mention Arabs and Muslims, can only think of ways to imprison them, kill them, capture them, and then destroy their entire societies and transform their cultures into some sort of militant Christian, we'll kick your ass if you don't worship the way we do society. I've watched and listened to that speech three times. It was a great speech. However, I have to wonder how our policy in that region has changed. This is something we all voted for. We voted for change, and that was part of the change we voted for, is it not? Was it not? We've even expanded the war in Afghanistan, and it looks like Pakistan's going to blow up any day now, and guess who will be in there? And we're running covert operations and military engagements in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Palestine, and we are once again watching from the sidelines while the Israelis carry out attacks against Lebanon and Palestine, with weapons, I might add, supplied by the United States. And in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, we're carrying out the attacks by ourselves. We've even been sponsoring a group that's been carrying out terror attacks in Iran. And I've listened very closely, and I've read between the lines of this speech, and I believe President Obama would have us believe that the worst problem in the region is the Holocaust denial. We've heard that tune before, many, many times. And while Holocaust denial is ridiculous, it's absurd, why is it that he said nothing to condemn the Israelis for the inhumane concentration camp-like conditions that they've imposed upon the Palestinians? It's apparent that it isn't permissible, and that is the right word, it isn't permissible for any of our political leaders in the United States to say anything negative about the treatment by the Israelis toward the Palestinians. And if I didn't know better, I would think the Palestinians were just the victims of some really bad luck or natural disasters. That's what our politicians would have us believe. We hear a speech from our leader that the Palestinians have to abandon violence. He says the Palestinians have to reach their goals in a nonviolent way. And although I'm not in favor of violence, I find that statement just a bit offensive, especially if I were a Palestinian. The Palestinians have tried nonviolence, and what did they get for it? They were thrown in Israeli prisons. They were thrown out of the country. Their land was taken away from them. They had their citizenship taken away from them. And some of them were killed for their efforts. And what did the U.S. government do to stop any of that? Nothing. Nothing at all. I heard from a friend who told me this, that he thought if Martin Luther King had been a Palestinian and launched an action like the Montgomery bus boycott in the occupied territories in 1956, he most likely wouldn't have lived out the week. The Israelis would have tortured and killed him. And so I believe that for President Obama to be given advice to the Palestinians after we've done almost nothing to help them, was absolutely wrong of him. And President Obama went on to say that we have no intention to retain permanent military bases in Iraq and Afghanistan. Evidently, he hasn't kept up with our very own plan for withdrawing from Iraq, which calls for still leaving 50,000 troops in Iraq. Is that not a permanent presence? And we're expanding the war in Afghanistan. What the hell is it about these conflicts that we, the people, aren't being told. Does making more war in Afghanistan make any sense to you? I'm really baffled by it. I am. And I guess we'll just keep flying drones over the place and killing civilians. Drones controlled by some guys in air bases and sitting in trailers on an air base in California. I'm just very disappointed that I didn't hear anything in his speech to say that any of our policies in the Middle East will be changed anytime soon. Yes, there is a euphoria over the speech right now, and a lot of it was really great. But as time passes, I think the people of that region will see that nothing's changed for the better, unless things change very soon. I was disappointed that all of the blame for everything was put on others, and is the Israelis, who are guilty of much in that area, escape condemnation totally. Yes, he did suggest that they stop the settlements. He should demand that they stop the settlements. Well, that's what I had to say about that speech. As speeches go, it was a great speech. And I hope lots of good comes from it. Lots of good come from it. We're going to be joined by one of our guests coming up pretty shortly. In the meantime, I was looking at the financial news today, and we're talking about the woe is us attitude of the auto dealers. I don't blame them. Many of them losing their businesses altogether, trying to stave some of that off. Not having much luck, they are going to close a lot of dealerships. And a lot of them say they're having increased floor traffic. But the one thing they're not having increase in, and it's the one thing we said we hoped it was going to be helped by the stimulus program. And so far we don't seem to be getting any cooperation from the financial institutions. We were hoping that credit would be opened up once again. And the people would be able to borrow to buy automobiles and stimulate the auto business. I don't know. And, of course, it's doubly difficult to get a home loan right now as well. I don't blame the institutions for being somewhat reticent about passing out loans. They were far too easy before. But that doesn't mean they have to go crazy the other way right now. Don't think it means that at all. Other big thing in the news, I haven't looked at the market in the last hour or so, but last I saw, oil was up to $71 a barrel. Will the price of gasoline going up again strangle whatever progress that we might make in this economy? I think it will. When gas gets outrageously expensive, people don't travel as much. They don't go out and buy as much. They don't have as much. They don't have as much income to spend. Extra income. Meant to say disposable income. That eats it up. So that's not good news. And they are talking about possibly giving us a break on gasoline tax. And I don't know where that money's supposed to come from. If they cut the gasoline tax, how are they going to maintain the roads? If they can't maintain the federal highways, you know who's going to have to do it? That means the state and local governments will have to do it. And where are they going to come up with the money? They're going to tax you. That's how. So I don't know that lowering the gas tax, although at first blush that sounds really good. I'd like to pay less for gas with the tax, but it does pay for taking care of our roads. And keep in mind, somebody's got to take care of the roads. And if the feds don't, state and locals will. And they will get that money from you. So, I don't know. Mortgage applications are the lowest that they've been since November. That's bad news. you know, not even approvals, applications. People aren't even applying. Some of that has to do with the recent jump in interest rates. I, for one, believe they'll continue to go up. I think we've passed the low point and are headed back up again with interest. We shall see. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we're going to pause for just a couple of minutes and get our first guest on the phone, and we'll be back. Welcome back, everybody. Good to have all of you along with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show. And we have with us right now someone I promised you that we'd have with us. We've got Chris Steller with us from the Minnesota Independent. Chris, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
We invited you on the program today to talk about a very serious subject.
I'm kind of sober up.
But yeah, and I can't help but laugh about it when I talk about this serious subject. We called you to talk because you wrote a story about, Michelle Bachman.
Michelle Bachman.
And it's She's an amazing creature. That's all I have to say. Now she's saying.
She's a cottage industry for us in the alternative media.
Yeah, as we talked about earlier.
Almost a heavy
today.
Industry.
Yeah, as we talked about earlier today, she's job security for you. All you'd have to do is follow her around.
That's right. She's my retirement, long as we keep voting her into office.
Why don't you just go to Washington, D.C. and follow her around all day long?
That sounds like fun. We try to do that when she's in town here. She's sort of famous for not holding town hall meetings. She holds these cyber town hall meetings that, you know, it's even better than what Bush used to do with picking your audience.
Well, come on, Chris. If you were her, would you hold a face-to-face town meeting with somebody?
I suppose not, just to be fair.
We'll put her and Sarah up on the stage together and let people have at it. That ought to be really good.
They have shared a stage before, and it's like lightning in a bottle.
Really? I have that. You know, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I wrote about that, and I don't remember the occasion, but it was since the election and one of these conservative functions that Palin didn't back out of. Most of them she did. But
I'm sorry.
They're quite a pair.
Sorry I missed that. Once again, we're talking with Chris Deller of the Minnesota Independent, and we want to give your website. I'm famous for forgetting that. What is the website address?
You more or less said our website. It's MinnesotaIndependent.com. And
but you know, most people outside of your state don't know how to spell Minnesota.
Good point. Okay, we do have a nickname. We have a nickname, which is MNINDY.com, MinIndy.com. Yeah, it's not much better, but...
Well, it is better. I mean, it's like the people from Connecticut and Massachusetts. They have the same problem.
You're right.
So Michelle says now that the country's being run by gangsters?
Right. She picked that up from a right-wing columnist named Michael Barone.
Oh.
And she used it in the context of the auto industry. She's very suspicious when the government, gets in the back room with some of the auto executives and starts telling them what to do, according to her. So, she was very suspicious of that. I think that amounts to gangster government. And she really laid into our one senator. You know, we only have one senator in Minnesota right now.
Oh, yeah, bless her heart. Amy goes out and does a little work and tries to get a dealership to stay intact. And Michelle's all over about it. And it's not like Michelle didn't try it, because she did, didn't she?
Exactly. Amy actually succeeded. Amy Klobuchar, one senator, succeeded in getting a GM dealer off of that list. And that's quite an accomplishment. But that made Michelle Bachmann very suspicious. And when we went to her website, she had a news article there in which she was boasting of doing the same thing with a dealership in her, or trying to do the same thing, I should say, with a dealership in her district. So, you know, we figured if it's a gangster government, well, she's part of it.
And she wasn't successful with her attempt, was she? Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, I haven't followed the ins and outs of that one, but she was basically trying the same thing. So,
I mean, you gotta look at, you gotta be real here. If you look at this situation, and you're the powers that be, and Amy Klobuchar comes to you and asks you to do that, and you got Michelle Bachmann, which one are you gonna pick? I mean, come on.
Well, that's right. Klobuchar's got the power of two senators.
Well,
sort of.
She does, and she's also got a great power of persuasion. She's charming. She's smart. She's got it all.
We're going to see a lot of her, I think.
I think so. I've had the pleasure of being around her quite a little bit in D.C., and she serves you well in Minnesota. Well, tell me something. I've discussed this on the program before. There's two politicians that I probably talk about in this way more than any others, and it's Michelle Bachmann, who's I believe is completely insane, and the other one is James Inhofe from Oklahoma. And
right.
I have to wonder, how is it that people like this can get elected? What is it about Michelle Bachmann and the people in her district that sends her to Washington?
You know, we went on the road just a week or two before the election when it was looking pretty tough for her, because that's when she made that statement on MSNBC. She said something about Obama being members of the Congress being un-American.
Right, right.
And it looked at her challenger was having a surge. And so we went out around her district and interviewed people about that. And, you know, there's the power of incumbency for one thing. She was a one-term senator, congresswoman, and now she's in her second term. There's something sort of magnetic about her, something that people like about her on a, human level. Maybe they don't really hear what she has to say. That's a big problem, actually, is that some of her biggest gaffes and craziest ideas have not been really adequately reported, especially in the mainstream media, up until the last few months. Now it's kind of almost helping her along that the mainstream media pays so much attention to her. And we don't know what's going to happen in next time around in her district. But she's going to be formidable, regardless of what she says between now and then. She just has, whatever it is, she's our it girl.
Wow.
She's got it. Yeah.
Yeah, she's got it all right. I wanted to ask, and I don't mean this as an insult to the people in Minnesota in any way, but, is there, like, in her district a really huge mental institution or something where people get to vote, or are these just common folks? Is it a heavy-duty Republican, or is it split? How is it?
Well, she probably does have more than – our governor, who's trying to run for president, keeps talking about our state as left-leaning to make himself look a little better because he managed to get reelected last time, and he's a Republican. But – you know, her district probably does have more than its share of Republicans, if you look at the whole state. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's the wedge issues that'll peel off people that probably shouldn't vote for her, but do anyway. You know, she's kind of got it figured out. There's a chance, though, we're right on the edge where the next U.S. Census, we might lose a congressional seat. We're within 1,000 people of losing a congressional seat. And they don't count every student and every immigrant. That might happen. And if we get a Democratic governor elected, the redistricting process could go against her. It's a possibility. And she could lose her seat just through redistricting.
Oh, one can only. Well, now I'm not rooting against you, Chris. I understand about the cottage industry and all that, but.
I would be.
if anybody had to go, well. Chris, I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Guy James Show. I certainly appreciate your
insight. It's been a pleasure.
We who don't live in Minnesota, and we're talking to people all across the country right now, we do wonder about things like that. We've seen some anomalies. We think it come from Minnesota, but
just keep paying attention. We'll be happy.
Well, we will. And Chris Deller from the MinnesotaIndependent.com. And if you guys can't figure out how to spell Minnesota, just look it up or use your spell checker. All right. Chris, thanks so much for being with us on the program today.
So long. Bye.
Chris Deller from the Minnesota Independent wrote a great article in the Independent about Michelle Bachmann. She's nuttier than a fruitcake, isn't she? She's a piece of work. I don't know that we've ever run across anybody crazier than her, except possibly James Inhofe. We should have a contest. Who's the craziest politician you can remember? Let me see. Have there been any crazier than her? Inhofe might be a little crazier than her, but I have to think about that some. There've been some dandies over the years. There've been people that you wondered how that they kept from getting committed ended up in the House of Representatives or the United States Senate. There have been some people along those lines, no question about it. That was interesting talking to Chris. It was good of him to come on the program at the last minute. He's headed for a big family function there today, and it was good for him to take time out. We've got coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to have Jake Diliberto. And Jake, I don't know where he's at right now, but he's a former Marine, and he's the founding member of Vets for Rethinking Afghanistan. And you might want to look at that, rethinkafghanistan.com, if you want to be ahead of the game on that. And he's going to be with us coming up in just a few minutes. And then later on in the program, Congresswoman Alison Schwartz is going to fill us in on how things are going on Capitol Hill. She's from the 13th District of Pennsylvania, which takes in northeast Philadelphia and surrounding area. And she's going to let us know. She's a former health care executive herself, so she knows a lot about the subject and something near and dear to her heart. I dare not turn on the TV, or I will be sidetracked here. I don't know if the guard that was shot has died or is still in critical condition or not. At the Holocaust Museum in Washington. One thing I do know that I wanted to mention today, do you remember when the Republicans had a hissy fit? Actually, that's putting it very, very mildly. Just went crazy when people were overseas condemning some of Bush's actions. Some of our Democratic politicians made some remarks overseas, and the Dixie Chicks. Remember what happened to the Dixie Chicks when they spoke out against some things that President Bush did? You remember that? You remember how they went absolutely crazy? You remember how Clear Channel booted them off the air in most of their cases? Do you remember that? Just went nuts. Totally ostracized them. Totally. Just one moment. Just totally ostracized the Dixie Chicks, boycotted them and all that because it said, well, here we have this, Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois. Mark Kirk, Republican from Illinois, says, I told China not to believe U.S. budget numbers. Republican Mark Kirk appears to have taken a bold step in the debate over the budget deficit, openly telling a foreign government not to trust the administration in Washington. Imagine this. Congressman goes overseas to China and tells the Chinese, do not trust our president and our government. Something he's part of. Kirk spoke to the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank, and discussed a meeting he had with Chinese leaders. And let me quote, one of the messages I had, because we needed to build trust and confidence in our number one creditor, said Kirk, is that the budget number that the U.S. government had put forward should not be believed. This is a United States congressman telling people that we've borrowed money from another country not to believe what our government says. Said the Congress is actually going to spend quite a bit more than what's in the budget, and the health care bill will probably be the lead driver of additional spending by the Congress. Is this not truly the very definition of treason? Can you think of anything more treasonous than that? Undercutting the President of the United States with somebody who's damned important to us right now in the financial world, and he trying to pull the rug out from underneath us, is that not the best example of treason you've heard in a long time? It certainly is with me. It most certainly is with me. I'm stunned over that. I really am. And he admits it. And do you hear any outcry from his fellow Congress critters? His fellow Republicans? Do you hear any outcry? Do you hear any news conferences on the Capitol steps about, oh, my God, it's not right to go overseas and say something against or to talk to a foreign government and undercut our... No, you haven't heard much about it, have you? And you certainly haven't heard anything about it from the Republicans. So there's another case, folks. There is another case of how far we on the left have to go to catch up in this media war. We are woefully behind. Here's a guy that undercuts the President of the United States, and it barely makes the news. Barely makes the news. I'm going to pause for a break and be right back.
You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download, to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio, and our songs will pass your test. You own country, you own western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you hoot on the music all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You hoot, sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You hoot, sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
So true, so true. You're listening to the Guy James Show here this afternoon. It's, what is this, Wednesday the 10th of June. Just having all sorts of goodies going on in the studio here this afternoon, so forgive me for a little technical glitch a couple of times. Anyway, we are glad to be with you, and we are going to right now, I think, if the phone's working right, we're going to go ahead and contact our next guest. That's what we'll do. Jack Diliberto is going to be with us. Jake. Hello, Jake.
Hey, how are you?
Jake, this is Guy James from The Guy James Show. Thanks for coming on this afternoon.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
We have spoken today about the appropriations, the money that they want to throw into Afghanistan some more. And thought it would be a good idea to talk to somebody that knows a lot more about it than we do. And we're speaking, by the way, folks, to Jake Diliberto. Have I got that name, that last name right, Jake?
That's right. That's correct, James.
Good. Jake Diliberto, and he's with an organization. In fact, I think he founded the organization, RethinkAfghanistan.com. Jake's a former Marine and a founding member of Vets for Rethinking Afghanistan, and we do want to welcome you to the program. And, Jake, you were a Marine, recently, a long time ago? When was your service?
Well, I entered the Marines in 2000. I have a desire to serve my country. In 2001, when 9/11 hit, I was with the 26th Marine Expeditionary Unit and was deployed to Afghanistan and participated in the Afghan a preliminary invasion, because the first part of it was just a preliminary setup and waiting for the army as well as a longer sustaining force to come in and secure the area and begin to develop sort of the political the political strategy for it all. And then so I left, and then in 2003 I went to Iraq, part of the Iraq invasion, and then in 2004 I got out. Once I got out, I got my bachelor's degree in political science, and I just about finished with a master's degree in ethics, and next year will be going to law school. And so a part of my schooling as part of my military experience, I wanted to be involved with the political process in getting Americans on board with thinking about national security, getting Americans aware of issues that pertains to them, and so which led us to this Rethink Afghanistan campaign.
And you mentioned something earlier on in your statement there that doesn't seem to go together. You mentioned political and ethics together in the same same breath.
Certainly. Well, to be honest, and my area of focus really is religion and politics, and religion in the public sector, and how the two intermatch, and how they, well, of course, don't intermatch sometimes too. And that was the field I decided, because I saw that as a big part of the American political rhetoric on the conservative and the liberal side. And so I wanted to understand this language and piece it all together.
Well, you've been there. Why isn't any sort of why didn't, I don't know how much we're pursuing it now, but why didn't any sort of program work, non-military program, not non-violent program, why doesn't it work in Afghanistan? Why can't we get to the people there and get them thinking the way that, and I hate to say it this way, the way we want them to?
Sure. No, I understand what you're saying. Largely what's happening in Afghanistan, the American people gotta realize that it is such a rural environment. It is so rural. I mean, there are villages that have largely been untouched by technology for decades. And because of that, the economic infrastructure of the region is absolutely deplorable. The borders are insecure, and it allows for political groups to take control that may not necessarily have the best interest of the state of Afghanistan as well as the surrounding regions. And that's why we've seen the opium trade being able to take charge of the region, as well as political instability as well.
Do the people there, with it being as rural as you say it is, and rather disconnected, do the people there actually worry about the state, or do they pretty much just worry about their own survival?
Well, that's a great question, and the reality is that the people there don't really recognize the state as a state. A great documentary was done by a Brave New Foundation on this, as well as BBC and other folks have been there and reported on this, that, the border between, say, for instance, Pakistan and Afghanistan is just, you can walk across it. There's not a legitimate border. And relatives and family members may be in one tribe on one side, and they may be in another tribe on the other side. It's not like Mexico and the United States, or Canada and the United States, where there's a border that we can recognize. And so as a result, they don't have an understanding of democracy or government or things like that. And as a result, there's an ABC and BBC, a news opinion poll that was done in March of this year, that recognized that there is 80% of the Afghans, oppose the escalation of troops in the region, because they don't see it as They don't even see it as anything positive because of mounting civilian casualties. And so the problem is only more confused when you say, okay, there's not a legitimate border. They don't recognize their political government, as well as they see mounting civilian casualties. So the solution that we're proposing to get people to think about, as well as several other experts on the situation, have testified before Congress in saying we need a multilateral coalition of forces to go in the region as a police force, not led necessarily by the United States, but a coalition of forces to provide security while we have a significant amount of well-resourced, sustainable economic infrastructure builders to go in and dig wells and big schools and hospitals and things of those sorts that can help the people have a legitimate state of their own. And how we do that, and this is something that the left and the right in America both, I think, need to hear, that just by putting boots on the ground is not going to make it safer. It's a big myth. There's a belief that, well, the surge in Iraq worked well because we increased troops. And the reason that the surge worked in Iraq was because there was a diplomatic answer as that component. There was a peacemaking initiative where we asked the Shia people to understand the relationships with the Sunni. And there's got to be a large part of that as well that is not being communicated or talked about. And so we've got to get people thinking about that, asking questions about that for a different kind of an answer.
Well, and part of the reason the surge worked, to my way of thinking, is we were able to go into the heavily populated area in Baghdad, for example, where most of the population is, and build walls in to separate people. That was certainly part of it. We're not going to be able to do that in Afghanistan. We're going to have to do this, like you said, some sort of a multilateral force to go in and
do this.
And how do we do that in conjunction with the Afghan government when Karzai really hasn't any authority? His brother, from what I understand, is known to be one of the biggest drug dealer, if not the drug kingpin in the country. How do we get a hold of and do this in this huge country?
Well, we proposed, we were in Washington just a few weeks ago, and we proposed to the Progressive Caucus, as well as several members of Congress and senators, including Jim Webb's office, and Dianne Feinstein, and a few others, we proposed that the United States it's important for everyone to know that stability in Afghanistan is a global problem, because Pakistan is a nuclear power. It has a lot of factionalism happening with the government, and if there is destabilization there, that would be something like the worst nightmare in the world. And so, it's important for every country in the world essentially has an interest here. And so the United States needs to recognize that and be an asset to the Arab community as well as the Pashtunistan region and create a, allies. Something you have to know about Iran. Iran is a bordering country of Afghanistan and currently has almost 2 million people addicted to the heroin trade. And for years, the Iranian government has spent millions of dollars trying to secure their borders, but they can only stop a third of the drug trade in there and are being plagued by it. It's directly going to Europe. So Iran has an interest in it, as well as Europe. One of the other components of it is that it has essentially no infrastructure for the people to be living. And so they're going to fight tooth and nail for any reason or any cause to gain some sort of respect or some sort of stability. So we've got to recognize those presuppositions before we can move forward, and how we engage this community, this state of Afghanistan, is by demanding integrity by the Karzai government. It is by a diplomatic solution of Pakistani, of Iranian, as well as the rest of the Arab League involvement there. If the United States is the sole state that's involved with the region, it will only destabilize it. And Andrew Pape has done the research on this. If you have a country that goes into another country for a police action, that is largely the opposite religion, that is seen as a long-term stay in the country, it will add fire to the, it will add coal to the fire of extremism and only invite suicide terrorism. And so we don't want that to happen. We want the state to be legitimate, and we want the people to be enfranchised into the rest of the working world. And so we need to use other assets besides looking at the United States as a sole policeman in the region.
So we have to now try and build a coalition while remaining in the background, because our name is mud in that area of the world right now. Are there any other nations that are as serious about this as we are, as worried about this as our government is?
Yeah, there are. That's a great question. Saudi Arabia is interested in being an ally in it, as well as the Iranian government, because, like I said, you know, they've been plagued by the heroin trade. Not only that, but you have to know that the Afghan and Pakistani border was established by the British when they were colonizing the world. And so Afghanistan, for the greater part of the century, really has not been that legitimate. And so we are founding a country essentially of their own for the first time. There has been stability from time to time, but not for a long time legitimate government. And so you can clearly see that there are a lot of assets that will be needed for this. If the U.S. is the only group that's involved here, it has nightmare written all over it.
The British and their border making in that part of the world. Oh, how successful it's been!
They were some decades ago, so they really needed. They probably could have used some help, I think, planning those. But you know, something else that brings us fast right directly to this. Supplementation bill that's been put forth of $100 billion to the funds for Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. And the big reason that we lobbied and asked the Congress to rethink this was because as a veteran, I support my government. I want President Obama to succeed. I want the Congress to succeed, and not just because it's Democratic or because, you know, Obama is, you know, a charismatic leader. I want them to succeed because I believe in the American way. I believe that the American government has done a lot of great things. And what we wanted to see a foreign policy that had success written on it. Not just left or right, but a successful policy. And Obama himself said in 60 Minutes that there's got to be an exit strategy. He said it himself. And so, he has no interest in aspirations for there to be a long-term sort of role in Afghanistan. Well, okay, before we can give you $100 billion of the taxpayers' money, President Obama, we want to see an exit strategy. And it doesn't have to be, all that planned out, because the mission can change. But we need to say, okay, we're looking to have such and such done by a such and such date. This way we can gather a coalition of countries on our side, and they can see us as elements of a global partner, not a dominating sort of, you know, oppressing force. And I don't think that we've necessarily been that. You know, I think that we've done a lot of good stuff in the Middle East, while at the same time we are not perfect at all. We've got a lot of errors in that, and we've got to be aware of that.
Well, I would hasten to say that we probably have a much better chance of building a coalition right now than we did a year, 2 years, or 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, and the big problem here's why. I mean, if we're going to talk political strategy, the reason that the state of Afghanistan must succeed for the U.S. Sort of the U.S. strategy over there to be successful is because if the state of Afghanistan is not seen as rational, then the United States has the freedom. Well, not so much the freedom, but they can justify preemptive war. They don't have I'm not saying it's right, but they can justify it. And that's what we saw with Bush in the Iraq invasion. He saw Iraq as an irrational state, and so there was preemptive war was used as a means of international conflict and security. And so that's, you know, if we don't set up scenarios so that the states can be successful and that we create allies in the process, we have another Iraq written all over it.
Well,
does that make sense?
It does make sense. And Jake, what I know we're talking about the 51 Democrats holding their votes.
Indeed.
What chance do we have of doing that?
Well, I think I want to tell the listening audience as well as you that every person who has an interest in this that understands what we're saying, that there's got to be a practical answer and not irrational spending. They can call their congressman. They can call the House operator, and I'm going to say the number right now at 202-224-3121. And ask the operator to direct them to their congressman's office and just let them know that they to vote no on the supplemental bill and ask for an exit strategy to be amended. The Jim McGovern bill we lobbied to get people on Congress to co-sponsor, and in 3 days we talked to 63 offices and 60 of them got on board with it. So, I mean, there is a huge movement within Congress that wants to see an exit strategy, that wants Obama's statements of an exit strategy to be enfranchised. Congress will move forward in some way, shape, or form with an Afghanistan strategy. We've just got to make sure that it's the right one. And we're close to getting an exit strategy mandated. We're close to getting the funds denied at the moment, and I think that's a good thing. We're very close. I mean, we're just a few votes shy, and any bit can help.
Well, Jake, you're an eloquent spokesman for your cause. You've spelled this out as well as anybody could. Do want to remind everybody that Jake's website, RethinkAfghanistan.com. That's RethinkAfghanistan.com. We'll tell you a lot of what you need to know about this. And, Jake, I do want to thank you very much for being on the program this afternoon, and we'll be in touch again to see how this goes along.
Great. It was my pleasure. And again, if I can just reiterate that phone number.
Yes.
It's 202-224-3121. It's 202-224-3121, and it's the House operator. You simply call the number and ask to be connected to your congressman's district. If you don't know what it is, they'll be able to tell you. And you just call and say, I would like to urge my congressman to vote no on the supplemental bill. Something else. I'm sorry. You've got to know this. There was a $100 billion amendment added by the Senate last week to bail out the IMF. So it no longer went from a $100 billion bill and went to a $200 billion bill in 1 week.
Right.
And whether you're liberal or you're conservative, this is an outrageous thing for us. And we've got to let our congressman know that it has nightmare written all over it.
I agree. Jake, thanks very much. Got to run. Top of the hour. Thanks for being with us. We'll talk to you again soon.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. You listen to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We're going to pause for news at the top of the hour, and we'll be back.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. On Tuesday, GM began sending out notices to salaried workers outlining reductions in benefits they can expect once they retire. According to a memo sent to workers by CEO Fritz Henderson, the changes will impact current salaried workers who will be retiring in the future. Dental, vision, and extended care coverage will be eliminated from the retiree health care plan for non-Medicare retirees. GM is also mailing out more early retirement offers to workers as the company seeks to slim its workforce. Workers have until July 24th to take the option, which for some workers includes a payout of up to $115,000 and a $25,000 vehicle voucher. This is the company's fourth buyout offer since 2006, and the last round from earlier this year saw 7,600 workers taking the offer. GM announced yesterday it would be cutting 887 jobs at a Wentzville, Missouri plant. The cuts will take place on August 10th and cut the plant's workforce in half. The job cuts will come after a plan to idle the plant starting this week until July 27th. New York State employee unions have reached a compromise with New York Governor David Paterson that could save the state $30 billion over 30 years. Under the compromise, future employees will contribute 3% of salaries to their pensions for the lifetime of their careers and will additionally raise the retirement age from 55 to 62. Currently, workers only contribute to pensions for the first 10 years of their careers. Workers will now need to wait 10 years to be vested in the state's pension plan instead of the current 5 years. The state will also offer 4,500 workers buyouts of $20,000 and end a plan to cut 8,700 jobs. The deal doesn't cover state workers in New York City, police officers, teachers, or firefighters. In Los Angeles on Tuesday morning, city workers protested in front of City Hall, expressing their outrage at proposed layoffs. According to a statement issued by a coalition of unions representing 22,000 city workers, the city council was being asked to abandon a short-sighted plan that would devastate city services. The council is seeking to initiate every other Friday unpaid furloughs, set to start on July 1st. Overall, there could be 26 furlough days and 1,600 job cuts, but according to the city, on Monday, 1,200 of those jobs being targeted are already vacant. Los Angeles is facing a $529 million budget shortfall.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
If you don't clean up your room, the Board of Health is going to condemn it.
The Board of Health doesn't even know about your room. What's more, they don't care.
You know, if you keep making that face, it's going to freeze that way.
Not unless you're someplace really, really cold. Actually, a lot of the warnings moms hand out are a bit exaggerated.
If you don't get your blood pressure checked, you could have high blood pressure, not even know it, and you could die from a stroke.
But she's right about that one. Fact is, high blood pressure contributes to 200,000 American deaths each year. And a third of those who have high blood pressure don't know it. If they did, it'd be simple to treat. Call the American Heart Association at 1-800-AHA-USA1 or visit AmericanHeart.org on the web to learn more. Better still, ask your doctor to check your blood pressure.
If you run with those scissors,
it's the least you can do.
My fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
Do you believe the things
Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey there. We're back after the news, and so are you if you're listening. Thanks for joining us this afternoon here in the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network, America's oldest liberal network. That's right, America's oldest liberal network. Welcome to the program. Glad to have all of you along this afternoon. We are expecting a call in the next 2 or 3 minutes, so we'll keep the phone lines open. We're expecting a call from the office of Congresswoman Allison Schwartz from the 13th District in Philadelphia, a former healthcare executive herself, and we want to talk to her about health care today and where she thinks this bill is going and if we're going to have a public option in it. She is very well versed on it, and she'll be joining us in just, maybe 3 minutes or so. Did you know that this Rick Scott, who was forced out of the health care business several years back in a massive fraud case, now he's the leader of this anti-healthcare reform lobby? That's right, Rick Scott. The company that he was with, they like to say he's the Bernie Madoff of healthcare. The company he was with was defrauded the government out of hundreds of millions of dollars, and he got off himself. He was not prosecuted, but they had a huge gain in business over the years, and this was Columbia HCA. We're going to talk about it after we get done talking to the congresswoman. I want to do want to talk a little bit about the bonuses and salaries for some of the people in the healthcare industry. You wonder why some of this some of this healthcare costs so much. Wow. So here they have an obvious con man. Let him sue me. I know he wasn't convicted. But the FBI investigated the company. They raided the company's facilities with search warrant, and Scott was forced to resign from HCA. And the company pleaded guilty of fraud and agreed to pay the government $840 million. And it was the largest fraud case in American history at the time. And he was never criminally charged, and he continues to deny wrongdoing in this situation. But here he is, leading up the right wing's efforts to defeat a health care bill, anti-health care reform lobby. Remember what we said yesterday about how they just keep recycling these people over and over and over again? Here's a guy that's with dirty hands in the healthcare business, helped defraud the nation out of a ton of money, and he gets back into it. Congressman Pete Stark, a veteran of the last bruising round of fighting over healthcare reform, remembers Scott all too well. Stark recently sent his colleagues a letter, hoping to refresh their memories, calling Scott a swindler. If he's the conservative spokesperson against health care reform, there is no debate, says Congressman Pete Stark. Well, I'm glad Pete got that out there. Pete's known as somebody that speaks his mind, and I like that about him. But if a guy's a crook, he's a crook. And this guy is, and here he is helping lead the ad war in all against a health care bill that we might get. It's easy to see why the costs are so high. It's easy to see why over and over again people are going bankrupt. People are losing their homes. People are losing everything they have. And most of all, a lot of people are losing their lives, losing their health because they don't have adequate health care. And, yes, there are places in the country that will take indigent people in, that will take folks in and pay for it, but certainly not over the whole country. And there are many models that we can look at around the world that has better national health care. Well, they have national health care. We do not. We certainly do not. And it's something that's sorely needed in this country. Don't tell me we can't afford it. If France can afford it, if Great Britain can afford it, if Canada can afford it, we can afford it. And don't give me all the crap, and I've heard it all, about all the long lines in Britain, the long lines in Canada, how these people have to wait for care and all this. If you've got something seriously wrong with you, you don't have to wait in long lines and wait for health care. You may not have the cushy offices that some of these people have in this country, but you're going to get good health care, and you're not going to see a bill when it's over with. And, yes, it is included in your taxes. But because they've controlled the cost, because they've kept the cost of medicine down, they've kept the cost down. They've got it under control. And, yes, government has done it. Government has done it in those countries. So don't tell me that we can't afford a public health care option in this country, because we can, and we will eventually. We will eventually. And you can start with all the socialistic talk you want to. We're all Marxists now. We're all neo-Marxists. We've heard it all. We have heard it all. So don't give me that. I just don't want to hear it anymore. We've got about 3 more minutes, I think, until Congresswoman calls. I was originally thinking it was 4:10. It's 4:15. I watched a documentary. And by the way, Jake Diliberto was talking about that documentary about Afghanistan. And a good friend of mine made that. Bob Greenwald made that. And Bob's been to Afghanistan. And you want to watch something interesting, go over to that website, and I believe you can get a hold of that right there and watch it. It's something you do want to see, believe me. Bob is really great at making documentaries, as most of you know. Got to see him last week for a little bit, and doing well. He's in the same boat as the rest of us. It's hard raising money right now to keep projects going, but somehow we'll survive, we hope. We're being positive about that. We did talk about Michelle Bachmann, and when I think about Michelle Bachmann while I'm waiting for Congresswoman Allison Schwartz to call, wasn't this sweet? What was it, Monday night? This Sarah Palin and Newt Gingrich mess. I'm going, I'm not going, I'm going, I'm not going. And then the little tiff between her and David Letterman. What was it he called her? She looked like a slutty airline attendant. And she didn't take kindly to that. I guess no one would. But Dave, you know, Dave's Dave. And she came back and got real serious over it, not remembering that David Letterman is a comedian. Got to have thick skin if you're going to be in politics. But yes, Palin was not allowed to speak at the dinner the other night, but her and Todd, her husband, they walked across the stage with Gingrich and his wife, and it was duly noted that most of the camera people and most of the crowd at night was at Sarah Palin's table. Now, I got to tell you, from my side, my political way of thinking, if Sarah Palin ends up on the ticket, oh, color me happy. I'd be really happy to have Sarah Palin run on the ticket. Let's see. The only better thing would be on it if it was Palin Gingrich. How about that? That would be sweet. I would love a Palin Gingrich ticket. That would be more than we could ever hope for. Much more. Good afternoon.
Yes, hello. It's Congresswoman Allison Schwartz for the Guy James Show.
Yes, is this the Congresswoman?
Yes, it is.
Well, this is Guy James, and we welcome you to the Guy James Show. You are very prompt.
I think it's about the right time, right?
Yes, absolutely. Right on the money, right time. So I'm just between you and I. With the rest of our friends in Congress and the House and the Senate, they're always not as prompt as you are on the phone. but I understand their circumstances. Thank you for coming on the program. We have Congresswoman Allison Swartz from the 13th District of Pennsylvania. That, if I have that right, that's like Northeast Philadelphia and some of the surrounding territory.
And the surrounding suburbs, yep.
Yes.
In Montgomery County, if anyone's knows Philadelphia and the suburbs.
Yes. Philly. Love Philly. You gotta love Philly. The whole nation loves Philly. The city of brotherly love. And it is. Known for many great things. But we asked you to come on the program today to talk about the health care, and there's probably not many folks in Congress better qualified to talk about health care than you are with your background. Could you give us a little bit of your background in that industry?
Well, certainly I can say that I worked as a healthcare executive for a good many years in Philadelphia, ran a health center, and then worked for the city of Philadelphia in health and human services, and went on to the state senate where I did a lot of healthcare policy, including helping to start the children's health insurance program 5 years before the federal government did, and even came to Congress to testify on how we could find a way to help ensure children in this country of children of working parents. And really my goal has always been to see if there isn't a way for us to make sure that those with insurance get meaningful insurance and quality health care, that we contain costs for everyone, and that we make sure that everybody is able to get coverage. And that's been a goal of mine, and been very involved here in Congress in making sure that we use information technology, health IT, in order to, again, be able to be more efficient, to assure quality health care in this country. And we did a major step forward on that in the Economic Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which we, of course, passed earlier this year under President Obama.
Well, we were talking right before you came on about the other countries. A lot of people have seen the documentaries and read all the news and the stories. My listeners are particularly keen about this subject, as is most of the country right now, I hope. Great Britain and France and Sweden, some of the Scandinavian countries and our neighbors to the north, they all have good national health care programs. And although not perfect, why can't we afford a national health care program?
Well, let me see. It's a question of we have a system that is working for a lot of Americans and not working for too many Americans. And my own sense is that Americans want us to come up with a uniquely American solution. And even the countries you name, all the countries in Europe that have some sort of a commitment to a universal coverage, all do it slightly differently. You know, we sort of tend to talk about the Canadian system, but they all do it slightly differently. Germany does say everyone's covered, but they actually use private company insurance companies and give choices to their citizens to going forward. And so I think what we want to do here is recognize that the cost of healthcare coverage is just going up too rapidly. And that is hurting businesses, and it's certainly hurting families and individuals who simply can't afford it. And, of course, we've often seen that people who do have insurance don't really have meaningful coverage, and we need to fix that as well, so that someone who hasn't coverage but finds out that, oh, it didn't cover outpatient cancer treatment, or it didn't cover a pre-existing condition, that's pretty unacceptable. Or it only covered as a lifetime limit and it didn't cover you. So we have to make sure that when you do have insurance that it is meaningful and it really covers what you need. And we have to make sure that we can extend coverage to, it's more affordable for more Americans, that everybody's in and gets the kind of efficient quality health care that helps them be healthier. And we can save money that way as well. So it's really a shared private-public partnership, and it's responsibility of employers, it's responsibility of individuals, and we all have to take that responsibility seriously. And I believe we can get that done. I believe we can come up with a uniquely American public-private partnership to make this happen.
Can we eventually get to a single-payer system?
I don't know. That certainly there are some people, of course, across the country and in Congress who believe that that is what we ought to be doing. But I don't think I know that it's not what we're going to do. And what we're going to do instead is to say that every American should be in, and we have to find a way to make sure that every American can find affordable health coverage. And we're gonna do that in a way by offering both private and a public option.
Well, as we all know, one of the reasons our healthcare system is broken and far too expensive and far too wasteful is the for-profit system we have making massive amounts of money. I have a list sitting in front of me of the pay of the executives. Aetna, for example, the executive top executive made $24 million last year. We have that. We have the high price of drugs that we won't bargain for like other countries do. It seems to me we've been working on this for at least 15 years. And, you know, we hear the folks in Washington, our political leaders, say we're going to do this and we're going to do that. We've had a long time to think about this. Why don't we have a real plan?
You are right in the fact that we have been talking. I personally have been working on this for years and years. We seem to get to the moment where we're going to try and do this, and then we don't. And that, to me, is unacceptable. I think the time is now for us to tackle this and to tackle healthcare reform in a really comprehensive way.
What's keeping us from
doing that, I will tell you, is that it's a complicated system that we have, and so fixing it is complicated. And we're trying to, one of the things we want to do is try and simplify it, make it easier for people to know what they're buying, to make sure that we know what works and what doesn't, and that we communicate that, and that we hold insurance companies accountable for, I have a bill, for example, I've been working on with another congresswoman that we've introduced that says you have to use the same language. You have to have transparency. And, when you say you're providing hospitalization, this is what it's supposed to mean. And everyone who says I cover hospitalization, this is what it means. So that people don't think they're buying something and then only to find out later that they didn't. Or, we don't let insurance industry exclude pre-existing conditions. It's outrageous. They spend a lot of money looking through our health records to see if they can't find some reason to deny coverage. That's unacceptable. And there's lots of paperwork that's costly for all of us, and we ought to get rid of that too.
Well, and we have a massive lobbying effort going on right now. I was in the wonderful city of Washington last week, and I am aware of the lobbying effort that's going on from the insurance companies to water this down, to put in this trigger issue. They're afraid of competition from a government-run healthcare system. I thought everybody on the right and the big businesses, I thought they believed in the free market.
That's right. Well, they shouldn't be afraid of competition. We are looking to make sure that as there's competition between the insurance companies, private plans, and a public option, that is going to be fair and transparent and a level playing field, as they say. But the fact is that the insurance industry has not been very successful in making insurance affordable and meaningful for particularly very small groups and small employers and individuals. And we want that marketplace to work. And certainly no one should be afraid of covering all Americans. No one should be afraid of, if they can't compete with a public option, then they're not as creative and innovative as they typically are. But we also want to make sure that we hold them accountable for doing the right thing by Americans and by their subscribers. I will say this, yes, while they are opposed to our creating a public option, and I believe that we will create a public option, I certainly believe we should, that we also know that a lot of people want private insurance and that should be available so that if there's a lower income working family and they get we have a sliding scale so they pay something and then they get some a subsidy in order to be able to afford it, they can take that to a private plan or the public option. So they're going to be able to really shop it. But they're going to have to be very straight up and honest about how they do this. And we're not going to, we don't want them to game the system, get people in because they offer something fancy for the first month and then not give them what they need for the next 11 months. That's just not the right thing. And I will say this, while there certainly is, a lot of interest groups out there talking to members of Congress and others, that the fact is that many of those stakeholders, as we call them here in Washington, the insurance industry and hospitals and doctor groups and advocacy groups are really at the table trying to say, okay, this time we're going to try and be with you and try and get it. We want to see it get done, too. Now, that could all fall apart, but that is the goal here, is to try and keep everybody as much at the table and to try and come up with a reform that really works My feeling is it's got to work for the American people.
Well, Congresswoman, we believe in complete transparency on this program, and we all complain about how the healthcare industry has spent a lot of money on campaigns. Have you received any money from the healthcare industry for your campaign?
Certainly have.
A lot? A little?
You know, I couldn't even tell you what it is, but I can tell you this, that I looked at public financing of campaigns. That would get us out of all of this, wouldn't it? It would be great. But in fact, I do. But I also, sometimes I agree with them, and sometimes I don't, and they know that.
So
that's what's most important, is to understand that I try to make the best decisions, again, for my constituents and the American people. I'm determined and do push all sorts of sectors. I sometimes get, when you say get from the healthcare industry, you know, you can get from competing parts of the healthcare industry, too, you know. So they don't all agree. But the fact is that I am very actively involved in healthcare and try to move this forward. And that means listening to all of the players and understanding the consequences of our decisions. And I think that's an important thing to do. And, again, most important for me is to make sure that Americans have the kind of health care that they need that will help improve their health status, that we use taxpayer dollars wisely and well, that we pay for care that really makes a difference in people's lives, and that this is a real shared responsibility, again, between employers and government and individuals. And that's what it's going to take to really be able to contain costs in the healthcare system for families and for businesses, and to make sure that everyone's covered and that everyone gets quality care.
Well, I'll just take a moment and tell you, I know you're pressed for time, and the complaint I hear most often is, and the reason I brought up about the money from the lobbyists and the healthcare industry, we hear it all the time that Joe Smith down the street and I and anybody else, we can't have access like they get. They get all the access that they want. I've been in the lobbies of House of Representative members. I've been in the lobbies of the Senate offices, and I've seen the lobbyists sitting there waiting to get in with their briefcases, and they get in. But
well, we all try and see our constituents. If your member of Congress refuses to see you, that's really that's not so acceptable. We are. We certainly, our staff meet with constituent groups, and I do as well. That's always a priority for me. You know, they come and see me as well when it's a personal issue. We try and communicate. I'll have my constituents email me and tell me what they're thinking. I do town hall meetings and tele-town hall meetings and try and tell them what I'm up to and why I do it and try and hear from them as well and try and take all of that information, as well as you point out my own experience and expertise and try and make the right decision and represent their interests first and foremost.
Sadly, we have a chat room here at the program, and sadly, one of the members in the chat room I'm looking here is somebody that lives in Sweden and is an expat, and the reason they don't come back and live at the States is because of our health care system. And that's a sad thing to say about the United States of America.
Well, so what we can... We'll end on the fact that we should get it done. We should find a way, and this is the year to do it. We have a president who is anxious for us to do this and a Congress willing to do it, and as complicated as it is time for us to finally say we are going to find a way to make sure that every American has access to affordable, quality, meaningful coverage.
Well,
I'm working hard to get it done.
We have the numbers, and if we don't get it done, it'll be our fault. We certainly have the numbers, and it's going to be up to the Democrats to get it done. It doesn't matter what the Republicans think. I shouldn't say it that way. It does matter, but
no, because we actually would like to. We'd like to do it in a bipartisan
way.
We'd
like to, but you know,
right. In the House, we've gotten very in the House of Representatives, in particular, we've gotten very little cooperation from the Republicans.
If we fail,
you're right. So it's on us.
If we fail, it'll be because we didn't hold together this year. Congressman, I want to thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. I appreciate your time. I know you're busy, and it was good of you to come on the Guy James Show.
All right, very good to talk with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye now. Doesn't know how much they got for the campaign from the healthcare industry. I think I ought to have that written on the back of my hand if I were in Congress. And I think if I was going to be serious about getting a health care bill through the United States Congress, I don't think I'd take a contribution from the health care industry. Does that mean I would be defeated? I wonder about that. That's why I feel the way I do about campaign contributions. As you know, I've come up with the silly idea that there are no campaign contributions. A lot of people think that isn't workable. I think it is. I particularly hate it when corporations are allowed to donate money to campaigns. I think this should be completely disallowed. But anyway, we can look that up on how much the Congresswoman got for her campaign. And we do believe in transparency on this program, so there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that. I did. While we're on that subject, you want to know why the price of health care in this country is, well, let's not just say it's high. Let's say it's ridiculous. Let's say it's beyond anything that it ought to be. You know, it's absurd, the price of health care in this country. God help you if you got to go to the hospital in this country. God help you if you got to go to the doctor these days. Aetna Insurance, Ron Williams. Total compensation last year, $24,300,000. Does that have something to do with the price of health care? $24 million. Now, do you think Ron Williams gives a rat's ass as to whether or not you're in the hospital and you're getting good care or not, or they send you home after one day when you ought to stay three? Do you think Ron Williams gives a damn about that? I can tell you the answer to that right now, and I don't know the guy. No, he doesn't care. Because if he gave you the health care and paid for the kind of health care that you should have while you're paying for insurance with Aetna, he wouldn't be making $24 million, would he? H. Edward Hanway from Cigna, $12,236,000 last year. Angela Braley from WellPoint, $9,800,000. Dale Wolf from Coventry Healthcare, $9 million. James Carlson from Amerigroup, $5,292,000. Humana, Michael McAllister, total compensation, $4,764,000. The list goes on. Jay Gellert from HealthNet, $4,425,000. Are you telling me that these guys aren't calling their executives in and saying, squeeze every penny you can out of these people and pay as little as you can? You've seen the documentaries. You've seen the documents. You've seen the stories. You know what the truth is. Do these people need to be making that kind of money? You can take your free market for all I care. Capitalism is great. But there's times that you gotta put reins on a horse to keep them back a little bit. And this is one of those times. When we have a healthcare crisis in this country that we have right now, when we've got 47 million people uninsured in this country, that can't afford to go in for an operation, can't afford to be gravely ill, can't afford to even be sick, not them, not their kids, and executives making this kind of money off of insurance, give me a break. Damn. The opponents of a single payer, the opponents of a public option, tell you, oh, we can't have the government making life and death decisions. What the hell do you think these guys are doing? If the guy in the government was making the decisions to whether or not you had an operation or not, and if he made the wrong call, he'd be making it just because he was uninformed or stupid. If the insurance company made the wrong call for you, it's because of greed. and nothing else. Time and time and time and again, we talk about these 47 million uninsured people. But time and again, we hear stories from people like I related to you yesterday about the friend of mine, $2.2 million doctor bills right now. How does he pay that? Got a relative that went to the emergency room not too long ago. Was there for 7 hours in the emergency room. Not much treatment to speak of at all. $8,000. How do you pay for that? Where's the justification for that? Oh, we can't have the government involved. We can't have them making decisions on what kind of care you should have. And yet we've got people running these insurance companies. And hey, yes, we talk about the 47 million people that don't have insurance, but there's a hell of a lot of people in this country, and people don't understand. There's a lot of people in this country that do have health insurance that still get busted, broke, driven into the poorhouse, driven into bankruptcy with deductibles. Because somebody made a decision. I hate it when I hear that argument. Oh, we can't have the government running health care. Well, they sure as hell couldn't do a worse job of it than the private companies are doing now, could they? You certainly could not. You know, in a larger sense, this isn't some sort of abstract financial or political concept we're dealing with here. This is our health, our lives. And of being denied by a system designed solely around turning a profit by any means necessary, it is being denied by that. Your health, if you have insurance and you're paying insurance premiums, your health is being controlled by a company whose sole concern is making a profit. I don't know what to tell people anymore from other countries that ask us about this, because what do you say that we live supposedly in the richest country in the world? And let's face it, we got everything. We're going through some tough times right now. But don't tell me. You know, we've got money for wars here, wars there. We've got money for weapons up the wazoo that we'll never use and never intended to use. We waste more money every year than national health care would cost us. We do. And there's the usual suspects. Mary Landrieu. Take Mary Landrieu, for example. She doesn't support a public option. Oh, what a surprise. I got a quote around here someplace from Mary Landrieu. Oh, here it is. I'm not open to a public option. She said, I'm not open to a public option. She didn't make any bones about it. She says, however, I will remain open to a compromise, a full compromise, Landrieu told reporters Tuesday. A public option is not something I support. I don't think it is the right way to go. Well, hell no, she doesn't. You know why, and I know why. Because she's worried about keeping her seat in the United States Senate. That's the reason. Screw her. You know, it might be a little over the top to say something about her like that, but the no public options, you keep track of who the no public option senators are. And the chances are, and you mark my word, and you can look it up as true. You keep you keep track of who the no public option senators are. We'll keep a list here on this show, and we'll look them up on Open Secrets, and we'll find out who's getting the money from the insurance industry and who isn't. And that'll be your list of people that are against the no public option. That you can take to the bank. They've been bought off by the nation's biggest criminal enterprise. These people don't want competition from a government-run healthcare system. Hell no, they don't. Just what if the government could run it efficiently? What if they could run it for a lot less money than the insurance companies do and made real competition for them? And the insurance companies would have to lower their prices. And then Mr. Ron Williams wouldn't make $24 million a year now, would he? And then maybe they'd have to be competitive. You know, you got Ben Nelson is now saying he won't filibuster the public option. Well, isn't that decent of him? Isn't that just great? We finally are hearing, and one thing that drives me crazy, and it did when talking to the congresswoman there. We're thinking about this. We're talking about this. We're trying to find. I don't mean anything personal because she's a very nice lady and nice of her to come on the program. But this is a problem that didn't arrive at our doorstep yesterday. This is something that Hillary Clinton tried to get through in 1993. It was a big problem then. It's a bigger problem now. And it's a bigger problem now because we haven't done anything about it in the last 16 years. And maybe we haven't had a chance to do anything about it because of the political climate, but we have a chance now. And if any Democrat goes against a public option, they should be ridden out of Washington, D.C. on a rail. Their constituency back home should tell them where to go. You know, the House Progressive Caucus has got a public plan, things that they say have to be requirements for a public plan. And it's got to be enacted concurrently with other significant expansion of coverage and doesn't dare be conditioned on a private industry actions. As it's got to consist of one entity operated by the federal government, which sets policies and bears the risk of paying medical claims to keep administrative costs low and provide a higher standard of care. And it's got to be available to all individuals and employers across the nation without limitation. It's got to allow patients to have access to their choice of doctors and other providers that meet defined participation standards. Yes, there's going to be graft. There's going to be corruption. There has been now. The Medicare and Medicaid and all got robbed by lots of doctors across the country. But we're going to have to watch it closely. And the Progressive Caucus says one of the requirements is to ensure premiums, they got to be priced at the lowest levels possible, not tied to the rates of private insurance plans. That's absolutely important. And naturally, the Blue Dogs, all God bless the dude, Blue Dogs, they're sabotaging the entire point of a public plan by demanding that the plan has to follow some of the actuarial standards and regulations required of private insurers. If that's the case, what's the point? You know, fortunately, the progressives and so-called progressives and liberals outnumber the Blue Dogs, but the blue Dogs can kiss my yes. All right. Maybe it's time for a moment of levity in the program. I say that with tongue firmly planted in cheek. I'm going to find this cut here for you. I had to, what happened? You've all heard about the minister. Former Southern Baptist Convention officer, minister, on June 2nd called for the death of abortion provider George Tiller. He called it an answer to his prayers. And he said later on in the day that he's praying an imprecatory prayer against President Obama. Wiley Drake is his name, and he is the pastor. Now, can you imagine the people that go to this church? Wouldn't you love to stand at the door on Sunday morning and see the stupid SOBs to walk in that church? Wiley Drake, pastor of the First Southern Baptist Church in Buena Park, California, and former running mate of American Independent Party presidential candidate Alan Keyes. Yes, Alan Keyes, running mate. He said on Fox News he didn't understand why people were upset with these comments, quoted by the Associated Baptist Press from a webcast of his daily talk show. Well, and you thought the Muslims were the crazy ones, right? Let's hear from the dear minister right now. I love this.
And you said President Obama. Are you praying for his death?
Yes.
So you're praying for the death of the President of the United States?
Yes.
Do you are you concerned that by saying that you might find yourself on some kind of a Secret Service call or FBI wanted list? Or do you think it's appropriate to say something like that or even pray for something like that?
I think it's appropriate to pray the Word of God. I'm not saying anything. What I'm doing is repeating what God is saying. And if that puts me on somebody's list, then I'll just have to be on their list.
You would like the President of the United States to die?
If he does not turn to God and does not turn his life around, I am asking God to enforce imprecatory prayers that are throughout the Scripture that would cause him death. That's correct.
Is your view of Scripture and Christianity the only right one?
No.
It's not.
No, so everybody forms their own opinions. Everybody has opinions, for example, about imprecatory prayer. I have seen people over the last few years that initially did not even know what imprecatory prayer was. And once they found out, they realized that they had been missing a part of what God was telling them to do.
All right, let's go to DJ in Canton, Ohio. DJ.
Yeah, Pastor Drake. Isn't murdering Dr. Tiller for fear of sending a message an act of terrorism? He did it for a political agenda.
I'm not sure I understand your question.
You're praying for terrorism. You're a terrorism supporter.
No, I'm not a terrorism supporter. I'm a vengeance of God supporter.
How is murdering somebody in cold blood to cause fear for a political agenda not terrorism?
So
let him answer the question, sir.
Okay.
Well, because I didn't pray for his murder. I didn't know the man that shot him, did not pray that a man or any man would shoot him or murder him. I would never pray for anybody to commit murder under any circumstances.
You said you wished his wife to be a widow. That's him dying.
He said he prayed for his death, not his murder, but you wanted him to die.
Okay,
but that's what God said. Brother, don't get mad at me. Get mad at God. God said it.
I didn't realize you talked to God.
Absolutely.
You don't think your little prayers affect Looney Tunes coming out of the woodwork to do your acts? You don't think that supports terrorism? Honestly.
Honestly not. And matter of fact, they're gonna, what's gonna happen is, unfortunately, since this guy did murder George Tiller, it's gonna set the pro-life movement back considerably because we have been trying to do it legally and through the legal way.
All right. Thank you for the call, sir. Well, Pastor, you think you got what you wanted, huh?
Well, I think so, and I think we'll see in the days ahead other imprecatory prayers answered. God says very clearly in his word that we're to continue to pray, and he will answer our prayers.
How do you know there are not others performing imprecatory prayer for you? And maybe, they might be successful. Is that possible?
Well, That's certainly possible, but that's in God's hands, not in mine.
Do you claim to know God's will?
In some cases I do, not in all cases. I know this, that if I do die right now, I'll go to heaven when I die because I have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. That's why I'll go to heaven, not to hell. And the reason George Tiller went to hell when he died was not because he killed babies, as terrible as that was. If he went to hell, and I think he did, that's God's judgment, not mine, but if he did go to hell, it's because he did not accept Jesus Christ as his personal Lord and Savior.
You don't know where you're going to go when you die, and you don't know where George Tiller went. So you really don't have that information.
I don't know where he went, but I do know where I'm going.
Well, you really don't. Only God gets to make that determination. He doesn't tell you in advance, does he?
Well, yeah, he's already given me the advance that if I accept Jesus Christ as my personal Lord and Savior, that I will indeed go to heaven when I die.
All right,
and
well,
so I already have that locked in.
All right, I'm glad you know that. I guess you've got more knowledge than most people.
Got her locked in, he does. Got her locked in. As Pastor Wiley Drake, yes, in fact, he was the running mate of Alan Keyes, from the American Independent Party presidential candidate. Yes, that's true. He was on a presidential ticket with Alan Keyes, and he prays for the death of the President of the United States. Now, I believe in free speech. I do. God knows I say things on this program and other people don't like and don't agree with. Hopefully I've never said anything as offensive as what I just played. I laugh at it in a way, and in another way, I get tears in my eyes when I think about the real impact of it. That there are people that would sit in the pew of a Baptist church, a Southern Baptist church, on Sunday morning, and listen to this effing lunatic pray for the death of the President of the United States. I believe in free speech. But as in all things, there are limits. And when a man openly says he's praying for the death of the President of the United States, that is going too far. That is stepping over the line. And one last thing I wanted to talk about today. You know, you talk about the super stupid, and that man is super stupid, and he's insane, he's wacko, he's a vile human being. Vile human being. Doesn't deserve to be around decent people. Certainly doesn't deserve to be ministering to people. What the hell's the matter with the Southern Baptist Conference allowing a lunatic like that to be the pastor of a flock, for God's sake? But to move on. The guy sounded like he was on drugs. And speaking of drugs and drug junkies, you may have heard today that the nation's number one drug junkie, Rush Limbaugh, and his fellow wingnuts like Hugh Hewitt are organizing a boycott of General Motors as long as the government owns a piece of GM. Now, I'm not the brightest bulb, but I was thinking, wouldn't that hurt all of the Republican-owned GM car dealership owners? Wouldn't it? I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, these wingnuts were soiling their undies over the fact that a suspiciously high number of soon-to-be-closed GM dealerships were owned by Republicans. And the conspiracy that President Obama was taking out some political revenge on McCain supporters made it all the way to the Fox News Channel. And it turned out that the political party affiliation of dealership owners was merely due to the fact that 86% of all car dealership are owned by Republicans. So naturally, there would be more Republican owners affected than Democratic owners. Duh. But now, Limbaugh and his army of lunatic ditto heads want to boycott GM. And therefore, it would follow all of those Republican car dealerships. These idiots can't even keep one of their harebrained schemes going for a couple of weeks. No wonder the rest of the country has no clue what the hell they're talking about. I wonder how Hannity feels about that. You know, he's had GM as a sponsor for a long time. You suppose he's going to boycott GM now? Hey, I take back everything I said. I'm going to get rid of my Cadillac Escalade. Well, he about has to, doesn't he? Certainly Sean can't stay away from a boycott established and promoted by his good friend, Rush the drug junkie, child molester Limbaugh. Certainly he couldn't stay away from that, can he? I mean, everybody has to bow to Rush Limbaugh, including Hannity. So certainly he's going to give up that GM sponsorship, isn't he? One would think. And myself, if my ship comes in, I get a lot of money, I'm going to go out and buy me a new Fiat Chrysler. Now there's a new name, right? Fiat Chrysler. Never thought I'd hear that. And I think it's a bit amusing, the name, Fiat Chrysler, but let me tell you something. And I mean this with all my heart and soul. I hope Fiat Chrysler and General Motors return to profitability. I hope they end up being profitable like they never have before in the history of their company. And I hope it truly does happen. That's what's good for America is good for Fiat Chrysler and General Motors. Many hundreds of thousands of people depend on the auto industry in this company, in this country. And we cannot afford to let it go by the wayside. If General Motors and Fiat Chrysler prosper, the rest of us will be the better off for it. The union will be stronger, the UAW. There'll be a lot of jobs, non-union jobs, that'll be protected. It's important that those two companies survive. If I had the money, I'd be out buying a new one today. Because I believe we need these companies. We need them. Well, thanks for listening today. It's been a busy day here on the show. I've enjoyed our guest. I hope you have. I hope we all learned something from them. And I appreciate your listening. I certainly do. So, thank you. From the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. And don't forget, you've heard from the radical right. Oh, have you? But now all that's left is the truth. See you tomorrow, gang, and I got a great guest coming up tomorrow.